Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Starting on the international front, this is breaking news. UK Prime Minister Theresa May has survived a vote of no confidence triggered by members of her own party over her handling of Brexit. The results were announced by Graham Brady, a member of Parliament who chairs the 1922 Committee, which represents Conservative lawmakers in the House of Commons. She defeats the leadership challenge after Conservative MPs vote to back her by 200-117. The Prime Minister's victory protects her from another leadership challenge from within her own party for 12 months. But the result will not offer any assurances to the Prime Minister's supporters that she is able to get her all-important Brexit deal through the UK's Parliament. On another front, according to my first guest, the arrest of Chinese telecommunications CFO Meng Wanzhou has sent shockwaves through the global markets. The context of the smartphone industry and the new challenges facing big Western monopolies from Russia and China is vital background information for anyone who wants to understand these recent dramatic events. The CEO has been released on bail in Canada, setting her up for a lengthy legal fight over extradition to the United States. Now, President Donald Trump suggests he may intervene in the legal saga if it would help his pursuit of a trade deal with China. What's really going on here? For insight into this, let's turn to my first guest. He's a journalist and political analyst focusing his coverage on U.S. foreign policy and the global system of monopoly capitalism and imperialism. And he joins us to discuss this issue in the context of his latest article, Smartphone Wars, Yandex Huawei Challenge Western Monopolies. He is Caleb Maupin. And as always, Caleb, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, man. Thank you very much. President Trump is reported to have said recently, quote, "If I think it's good for what will be certainly the largest trade deal ever made, which is a very important thing, what's good for national security, I would certainly intervene if I thought it was necessary," end quote. Trump told Reuters this in an interview published shortly after Meng was granted bail by a judge in Vancouver. Ms. Wanzhou's arrest in Canada at the behest of the U.S. seems more like kidnapping, and Trump now saying that the U.S. might intervene if it helps his trade negotiations with China sounds to me more like extortion. What's your take, man? What's going on?
Well, it seems like Trump is confirming what many people suspected from the beginning, that this is not simply an issue of the rule of law. This isn't that this, you know, the CFO, the chief financial officer of the biggest telecommunications corporation in the world, it isn't simply that she's violated U.S. law and not reporting something relating to trade from Iran, as is being put forward. But instead, this seems to be related to the ongoing trade negotiation between U.S. President Donald Trump and the president of China, Xi Jinping. And it seems pretty clear that that now we have a human being who's become a bargaining chip in the ongoing negotiations that are taking place regarding tariffs and cars and steel and all kinds of other products. It sounds almost like Trump is trying to fight dirty, grab a very wealthy, prominent person in China and essentially hold them for ransom in order to try and extract a better deal out of the Chinese leadership.
Talk about this in the context of your piece, Smartphone Wars. What do you really see as being the crux here as it relates to Huawei being the largest cell phone, I believe being the largest cell phone manufacturer in the world? And also you have in your piece that there's a new phone coming on the market.
Yeah, I mean, Russia is about to launch the Yandex phone. There is a corporation in Russia that handles their internet. It's like the Russian Google. It's called Yandex. They've announced on December 5th, they came forward and they announced that they are planning to release a smartphone of their own. And, you know, it's pretty clear that smartphones are not anymore a monopoly in the hands of Apple and Verizon and Motorola and other corporations. It seems pretty clear that that these Western corporations are facing a rising level of competition. If you go to Africa, people have Huawei phones. If you go to all over Asia, people have Huawei phones. Latin America, even, people have Huawei phones, right? There are rising competitors emerging from the developing world. And these telecommunications corporations based in the United States are seeing competition emerging. And in a lot of ways, people are pointing out that these Huawei phones, they have a longer life than the American phones do. Apple, you know, they've been embarrassed with revelations about planned obsolescence and phones slowing down longer than they could. So you have to buy a new one. Well, Huawei is booming because in a lot of places, people feel like they make a better product. And it seems like rather than just letting the free market do its wonderful work of magical competition, we see American corporations and the American government stepping in to try and, you know, maintain a monopoly for these Western corporations and push competitors out of the market. And this isn't the first instance. I mean, we saw what happened with ZTE, another Chinese cell phone maker, and how there was ongoing issues with that, and it came up in negotiations, and they were fined and penalized. We also saw the FBI come forward and urge Americans not to buy Huawei or ZTE Chinese-made cell phones, saying it was just not in our interest. There's a chance that somehow the Chinese government might be able to compromise our privacy, as if the NSA and Google and the American government and American corporations aren't compromising our privacy all the time anyway. And we're seeing a level of hypocrisy, and it seems like on some level the rise of alternative cell phone manufacturers and smartphone makers around the world is seen as a threat, and the U.S. government is being mobilized against competitors.
There was a piece in The New Yorker written by Evan Osnos called Making China Great Again. And in this piece, he writes that there was a time in Chinese history when Chinese nationalism revolved around the concept or the idea of victimhood, the bitter legacy of invasion and imperialism, and the memory of a China so weak that at the end of the 19th century, the philosopher Liang Qichao called his country the sick man of Asia. Do you get the impression that Donald Trump and many of his advisors and minions are operating off of an old mindset of China being this sick man of Asia that they can bully, as opposed to understanding that they are flipping the script on the geopolitical landscape and kidnapping the president of Huawei's daughter is not a good idea?
Well, I think if you look into the details, let's remember that, you know, at the time you're describing, 19th century, around that time, you had two opium wars, the two opium wars waged by the British. And what was this about? Well, the Chinese government, the emperor, was trying to block the sale of narcotics and the importation of narcotics and put up other trade barriers and trade tariffs to kind of protect the local Chinese manufacturers and corporations. And as a result, the British then sent their soldiers in and waged two different opium wars in order to open up the Chinese market and let it be dominated by British corporations. The Germans had their military operations there. The first time that U.S. troops were sent to China was in 1900, and that was in response to the Boxer Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, and this was an upsurge of Chinese nationalists who called themselves Boxers. Our leaders in the USA said to the public that these Boxers were going around and they were persecuting Christian missionaries. So it was necessary to send troops to rescue the Christian missionaries. Well, the reality was that what the Boxers were doing was organizing boycotts of American and British and Japanese products and promoting the sale and the domestic manufacturing in China. And another thing that the Boxers were doing was lynching drug dealers. The drug dealers, people that were selling opium and narcotics, they were hanging them. And so the U.S. troops were first sent to China in 1900, long before Mao, long before communism, long before anything to do with any of that. They were sent there basically to beat back a nationalist uprising that was trying to build up and develop independence. And that when President Xi speaks about the Chinese dream, which is one of the points that he really emphasizes, if you look at what he's saying about the Chinese dream, is he talks about the concept of national rejuvenation of a country that has suffered so much humiliation and degradation. And then over the course of the 20th century, starting with Dr. Sun Yat-sen and the founding of Chinese nationalism in the Chinese Republic, then continued with Mao Zedong and the Eighth Route Army and the driving out of the Japanese invaders, all the way up into the founding of the People's Republic and eventually the reform and opening up in 1978 with the rise of Deng Xiaoping and socialism with Chinese characteristics, that China is a country that is pulling itself up by its bootstraps, overcoming centuries of humiliation and restoring its rightful place. I mean, they see themselves as a 5,000-year-old civilization. And at one point, they were where they are now. I mean, they were at one point, you know, when Marco Polo was going there and he said, wow, what's this paper money, gunpowder, all this stuff? No one has any of this in Europe. I'm going to take it back to Europe. China was the cutting edge of human civilization. And obviously, the things have changed, and they were at one point the sick man of Asia. But over the course of the 20th century, they've been restoring themselves. And the concept of national rejuvenation or the Chinese dream is very big, and that they essentially they don't want to be kicked around, and they want to be able to have a role in the global economy. And it seems like there is now a clash. You know, a lot of foreign corporations operate in China. Apple operates over there. I mean, the number of American corporations, British corporations, French corporations that operate in China is big. But if you operate there, they argue that you got to play by their rules. And American corporations don't particularly like that. You know, they like going into developing countries and saying, you're going to do it our way or the highway. And China doesn't play that game. You can do business over there. You can invest, but you're going to do it on their terms. And I it's pretty clear that a lot of, you know, whether it's Trump or a lot of the Democrats, they don't particularly like that. They don't like China dictating the rules around intellectual property. They don't like China. Basically not just being a pushover and letting these corporations that come over there do whatever they want. They don't like the fact that China, plays tough and likes to negotiate and be a little hard-nosed. And in the process, however, they have raised 700 to 800 million of their people out of poverty, and they've built the second largest economy in the world.
And, you know, it seems, though, that you've got people that are confused or are operating from an older version of history. I had a conversation here about China and their economy. And I said during the interview, when you think about China, I said, one of the things you now are thinking about in terms of their products is quality. And he said, oh, no, China doesn't make any. He said, China makes everything is disposable. Everything in China is cheap. And I didn't get into a debate with him, but I just thought to myself, no, that was a while ago. You know, I remember back in the 60s when Japan was playing that role. You didn't want anything made in Japan in the 60s. That was the worst, cheapest stuff you could find, with the exception of a Sony radio. But, you know, Japan evolved. China then played that cheap marketing role. But now, Huawei phones being an example, their telecommunications products, their telecom switches and other larger pieces of telecom equipment, that's quality stuff. So are we still dealing in the minds of many people with this old mindset of a particular China that current history no longer reflects?
Well, that certainly is the case if you look at Huawei phones. I mean, Huawei phones tend to last longer than Apple iPhones do. They actually tend to be quite good quality phones. It's not the case that they're just a cheaper version of American phones. That if people think that's the case, they're thinking back to the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. They're not quite understanding how these things tend to work. It is important to point out that the Chinese government, and I should say the government, not Chinese private corporations, but the Chinese government has really put an emphasis on technology and computers, and they poured a lot of money into, you know, just being on the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, of any, you know, data technology, anything new in that field. And they've really done that. And this program that the Trump administration seems to just hate so much, this Made in China 2025, that program, it is about China moving ahead in terms of technology. And, you know, the way it's characterized, you'll hear Trump administration officials and others characterize it as, well, this is China trying to just steal control of the market. But what they leave out is the fact that China has actually reached out to the United States and said, let's make Made in China 20
together
a joint operation.
Right.
Let's have American scientists, American universities team up with Chinese universities. Let's do it together. So if they were trying to seize control of the market, if this was some vast conspiracy to, you know, to have China take over the world, why would they then reach out to the United States and say, come on board, be part of it with us? That doesn't make any sense. That narrative that they have isn't exactly right. You know, Trump seems to believe that the way he's going to revive the U.S. economy is by getting the steel mills roaring again and getting the coal mines roaring again, and that's going to fix the U.S. economy. And that's not a very long-term view. Because if you look at steel mills today, the amount of workers they use, even if they were producing at full capacity, is far lower than the amount of workers they used just a decade ago or 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago.
It's called automation.
Indeed.
In fact, let me just jump in there to say that
sure.
What I'm seeing now is when we look at World War I, when we look at World War II, the United States was able to dominate through its military power. Now what we are seeing is China, through the advancement of technology and using technology to drive their economy, they are now becoming the world power, not through military force, even though if they had to go that route, they could. They are driving the economy through technology. And that is a huge element or a huge place where the United States just doesn't get it.
Well, that's an understatement. And it seems, again, that the Trump strategy for economic growth is based on nostalgia. He's telling the older folks, I'm going to make the good old days when you were young in the 1950s, when everyone had a house and a car and a factory job, even if they didn't have a high school diploma. I'm going to make that come back. I'm just going to build a lot of walls and tariffs, and I'm going to build a wall around the United States, and then magically the 1950s will be restored. Well, that's not how history works. History tends to move forward, not backward, you know?
And he probably wants us to go back to watching black and white televisions. So let's close this with going back to Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou. And she now has gone through a hearing in Canadian court. She has put up her, like $7 million, I think, is about what she had to put up. She's supposed to go back to court around the 6th of February. This process about approving or denying her extradition is expected to take a few months. How do you see this playing out, especially if Donald Trump has said, well, if this helps my negotiating position, I might weigh in on this? I don't know that President Xi would look very favorably upon Donald Trump trying to play him that way.
Sure. And I think there's huge amounts of outrage all over the world. If you see all over the world, there have been Chinese folks, but also other folks protesting about this. I've seen, you know, pictures of protests just all over the planet around this. And it seems like there's just a high level of outrage that this is just kind of classic bullying. We're going to grab somebody and hold them until you give us what we want. And it doesn't look like it's going to win the USA any friends or sympathizers around the world.
Well, what about Canada's role in this? Because in listening to you just now, what I thought about was, you know what? Donald Trump did not want to kidnap her on American soil. Those in his administration, because there are those who say that he may not well have known that this was going on. But they didn't want to do it where they capture her or kidnap her on American soil. So they use a third party, Canada. How does Canada play into this? How can they be that foolish?
Well, and some of Trump's trade deals have not been too good for Canada. There's been some outrage. And I guess at this point, the Canadians are going to have to make a decision. You know, is it in their interest to be perceived around the world as Trump's goon squad? As, oh, we grab people for Trump to help his negotiations? Or will it be in their interest to say, you know what, this is Canada, this isn't the United States, she hasn't violated our laws as far as we can see, this is America's problem, and, we're gonna just let her go and not have anything to do with this. And I think the Canadian public is not very favorable to Donald Trump. I think polls show that all across Canada, people are not very sympathetic to Donald Trump. And it appears to me that I don't think it's a shoe-in. You know, if some criminal, if somebody stabbed their wife and ran away to Canada, them being extradited would be, you know, automatic. It would be a shoe-in. I don't think this is going to be a shoe-in. I think that there's a lot of division in Canada about what's the right way to handle this situation.
So final question here. So is Justin Trudeau trying to be smart and say, okay, Donald, I grabbed her, but my courts let her go, and that was out of my hands?
We'll have to see. It's going to be a while. I guess she's going to be in Canada. She's going to be wearing an ankle bracelet.
Right.
She's got some other Huawei employees who are going to be there with her. And
in one of her two homes that she owns in Vancouver.
Yes, and apparently some people put up their homes for her.
Yeah, two very close friends of hers, one a real estate agent, and I don't know the other person. She seems to have friends in high places.
Well, indeed. I mean, if you're the CFO of the biggest telecommunications manufacturer in the world, you probably know some people.
And so, Caleb Maupin, as always, man, thank you. And you raised a point that I wanted to be sure that we got out, and that is it's important to understand that Donald Trump had Justin Trudeau kidnap this woman who has violated no Canadian law. She was not on her way to the United States. She had not even just left the United States. And so somehow Donald Trump gets his goon squad, that's a very good way to put it, to kidnap a Chinese national for allegedly violating tariffs on Iran. Boy, it's getting deep out here. Caleb Maupin, as always, man, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Today, U.S. District Judge William H. Pauley III sentenced President Trump's former attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, to 3 years in prison and ordered Cohen to pay nearly $2 million in financial penalties for financial crimes and lying to Congress. Cohen pleaded guilty in two separate cases. One was brought by special counsel Robert S. Mueller III, who is investigating alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election over Cohen's lies to Congress. The other was brought by federal prosecutors in New York over tax and bank fraud allegations and campaign finance violations. For deeper insight into all of this, we turn to my next guest. He is a professor in the Department of Politics at St. Mary's College of California, Dr. Hisham Ahmed. Welcome back, Dr. Ahmed, to The Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure being with you, Dr. Leon.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. So when you heard that Cohen was sentenced to 3 years and $2 million in fines, what were your thoughts?
Number one, I was not surprised in the least. I think that was to be expected. Number two, the second immediate thought that came to my mind is that now the devil's advocate is going to be in prison. What about the devil himself? In other words, this is a quite a strong message for Donald Trump that there are serious troubles that he is in and that he has to prepare for. The sentencing of Michael Cohen is yet another evidence that Trump has directed Cohen, to commit serious violations in terms of campaign finance laws, in terms of the payments to Daniels and McDoodle, in terms of other violations as well. We still do not know the whole scope of the legal troubles surrounding Trump, but I strongly believe that this is the beginning of the actual demise for Donald Trump. As a matter of fact, I have expected that last August would be the month. Well, yes, last August was when Cohen has pleaded guilty, and today is his sentencing. So I believe there are some difficult days, weeks, and months waiting for Trump, and not just for Trump, the person or the president. No, for the Trump organization and for the Trump immediate family as well.
You know, you mentioned the immediate family, and one of the things I was thinking was, is Donald Jr. or are Donald Jr. and Ivanka next on the chopping block? Because these things are getting very, very close to them. It's interesting that, you know, at first Trump denied knowing anything about the payments that Cohen now has admitted to making. Then he acknowledged that he did know about them. But now he's insisting that the payments were simple private transactions, not election-related spending subject to campaign finance laws. He's also maintained that even if these hush money payments were campaign transactions, that they should be civil offenses, not criminal offenses. So I go through that to point out two things. One, his story continued to change and unfold as more evidence against him was presented to the public. And the other thing is, by saying that even if these are campaign violations, now he wants to determine whether it's civil or whether they are civil or criminal offenses. And I don't know that he went to law school.
Well, we know for a fact now that Trump has not told the truth. And we also know that, of course, from his point of view, that everybody else is lying, and he's the only one who has the ultimate truth on all issues. But with regard to campaign finance violations, now we have Michael Cohen, and we have the National Enquirer. In other words, he can say that Michael Cohen is lying for as long as he wants. But since there is another entity that validates what Michael Cohen has pled guilty to, among other things, I think that leaves absolutely no room of maneuverability for Trump when it comes to the legal world. However, Dr. Leon, I think there is one serious danger, which I am sure I and others have, and I'm sure you have been detecting all along, and that is that knowing that he has some serious troubles coming up with the law, Trump has been appealing to the public. Mm-hmm. And trying to win the court of public opinion. Quite frankly, if we translate this into concrete words, he has been trying to inflame some unrest and some trouble on the part of public opinion. In other words, to arouse some supportive sentiments of him among certain sectors in society, so much so that in the event the question of his impeachment comes up, or in the event that Trump is indicted, whether during being in office or after, then some sectors in society will rebel. I think this is very dangerous. I think we have to pay very, very close attention to this, because he knows that the slogan he used to chant all along, lock her up, I think he knows quite well that now he is facing the danger of being locked up himself.
You know, looking at Cohen's sentencing, we now have Michael Flynn. We also have Paul Manafort. Flynn is asking the judge for leniency, and Flynn has submitted all kind of letters from people telling us how nice of a guy he is and how he loves to pet dogs and kiss babies. His lawyers are talking about his contrition, his lengthy military service, his willingness to aid the special counsel. Your thoughts on Michael Flynn's fate And where do you see Paul Manafort fitting into all of this, since they now have torn up his agreement, saying that he was not forthcoming with the truth?
Let's take the easy one first. For sure, I mean, this guy is getting a long jail sentence. I mean, now speculations, you know, are about spending at least 10 years in prison, lying, committing felonies, and so on and so forth. Now, with regard to Michael Flynn, Mueller has asked or recommended no jail term for him because he has provided substantial help for the Mueller team. I think that is going to be a tricky thing. I mean, the fact that Michael Flynn is a general, he has served the country, he has long-standing service in the army. I don't know if that makes him in a better position to be excused or to be forgiven from a prison term.
Many would say that he should know better, that because of his service, because he's a retired general, that we should expect more from him because he swore the oath to protect and defend the Constitution and obey the laws of the land and all that kind of good stuff. And so as a former general, we should hold him to a higher standard.
No question about it. Exactly. I mean, especially in terms of collusion with Russia or being, whether knowingly or unknowingly trapped into any interference, Russian interference in the election. I mean, you would expect that an ordinary person might fall into a trap like this, but not a retired army general who also might have some sensitive information. So I think this is going to be an interesting story to watch. Will the judge strike a balance, an equilibrium between the amount of helpful information Flynn provided to the Mueller team on the one hand and the need to use the Flynn story as a deterrence?
You know, one of the contradictions that I see with Flynn's, at least, statement from his lawyer is his lawyer says that Flynn is contrite, but in the same statement, he then says that he should be spared prison time because the FBI agents who interviewed him tricked him into lying. Well, you can't be contrite on one hand and then say, but I really didn't mean to do it because the folks that were responsible for conducting the interview tricked me into lying, so I'm really not responsible. To me, there's an inconsistency there. He didn't use the word entrapment, but that to me is what he was implying.
You know, you really hit the nail on the head, Dr. Leon. I am sorry to say this, but when I heard this statement, I just couldn't help it. I laughed, okay? I really laughed. I mean, to be tricked into lying. I mean, come on, give me a break. You know, we're talking about somebody who was the National Security Advisor. I mean, he teaches people, right?
How not to fall into those traps.
Exactly.
Let me quickly, because we're running out of time, and I want to quickly move to Tony Podesta and his Democratic-leaning lobbying firm, who for a very long time was being investigated by Robert Mueller. He was involved with Paul Manafort. And now all of a sudden, it seems as though Tony Podesta, you don't hear his name anymore. And so, if Michael Cohen has fallen the fate that he has, if Michael Flynn, because of his relationships with Manafort, is now looking at serious jail time, all of a sudden, Tony Podesta seems to, at least we don't hear anybody talking about it. One could very well ask the question, are Democrats immune from prosecution here? Or what's going on here with Tony Podesta?
I think this is an absolutely, absolutely important and very pressing, serious question that one should raise. It's hard to tell, My hunch, and I could be wrong, but my hunch that we have not seen except a tiny, tiny, tiny bit now of the Mueller work and perhaps a tiny glimpse of the Mueller report. And I believe Mueller is being careful to come up with these tiny bits in a timely manner because now there's serious concern that, Mueller himself could be dismissed. And I believe now by getting us to this stage, to the Michael Cohen stage and the other stages, certainly Mueller is making it a lot more complicated for Trump or anybody else in the Justice Department to consider for a moment to dismiss or fire Mueller from his post. So, yes, we maybe need to raise this question, and it is legitimate, and hopefully, and I think, we're going to see a lot more information, more than we expect.
What seems to be at least being set up here at this moment, at this juncture, and I take what you're saying very seriously, is people could start to ask the question, or should be asking the questions about selective prosecution. And it'll be interesting to see if some of the mainstream media entities start raising this issue, or do they just sit silently and allow this thing to proceed without those questions being asked?
Well, the mainstream media, as we all know, my goodness, it leaves out a lot to be desired on so many things. I mean, mainstream media has been a culprit in many ways in much of what has happened. That it's total failure to see the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. To me, that's a fiasco. That's a big, big embarrassment that they should be held accountable for.
Absolutely.
That moment on, you can think of so many other things where the mainstream media has been just basically filling some time. It's filling some space. That's all it is.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Dr. Hisham Ahmed. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Professor in the Department of Politics at St. Mary's College of California. Thank you so much for your time and look forward to having you back.
Always a pleasure, anytime.
Thank you, sir. Well, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And let me give a big shout out to those that are following us on Facebook. Thank you so much for doing so. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. I will be responding to your comments online as quickly as I can. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Senate was expected to vote today on a resolution to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led campaign in Yemen. It looks as though that vote won't take place until tomorrow. If successful, it would represent a significant shift for the Senate, which in March pigeonholed the same measure. Let's get an update on this and other related issues from our next guest. She's the executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities, Mac Hamilton. Mac, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks so much, Wilmer. Happy to be here.
So we were expecting a vote today in the Senate. Where are we now with this Senate vote?
Yes. So there was a vote. It was just not the final vote. So the vote that happened today was a motion to proceed, which in parliamentary speak is kind of a pre-vote vote. And so this vote advances the measure, but now we are in an amendment process. So there will be 10 hours of debate, and then amendments can be voted on, and then there will be a final vote on the legislation to follow. So we expect that to happen tomorrow.
Are they debating now? Does the clock on the 10 hours, has that started ticking already, or is that expected to start tomorrow morning?
I believe that begins tomorrow.
Okay. Now, the resolution, which was spearheaded by, I think, Bernie Sanders and Senators Chris Murphy and Mike Lee, correct?
Yes, that's right.
So Sanders, an independent, Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, requires the administration to withdraw any troops in or affecting Yemen within 30 days unless they are fighting al-Qaeda. Is that language still in the legislation? And if so, is that fighting al-Qaeda language a loophole?
So hopefully not. I mean, I think a lot of our military support is going directly to the Saudi-led coalition who's fighting a war against the Houthi rebels. So that's really the main part of the war that's causing these mass numbers of civilian casualties that are actually up by 68% this year. So a lot of the weapons, the mid-air refueling, the bombs that are being dropped on civilians are totally outside of the out of the al-Qaeda mandate.
That language is still there, but you're saying no, you don't see that that's really going to be a loophole allowing Donald Trump to continue supporting this Saudi-led atrocity.
I think that that may be a way that it will be spun, because that's ways that we've seen it spun before.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that Congress has its eyes on the president right now, and that they know the difference between fighting al-Qaeda and, you know, murdering civilians.
Well, they don't seem to know it yet.
Well, we'll see you tomorrow. The vote was, we did get 60 votes in favor. So.
You, Mac, you need to explain it to them. That's what.
I'm on it.
Thank you. Report back tomorrow. Now, also, there was activity in the House yesterday, correct?
I believe there was a vote today, actually, that was a rider to the farm bill. So the rider basically deprivileges the mirroring resolution, the War Powers Resolution on Yemen, and says that the rider says that the legislation cannot be privileged in this Congress, which basically kills that resolution in this Congress. Of course, we have a Democratic House coming in who I think will really champion this issue. But for now, it seems unlikely that the House will take action on the issue.
But it was thought that the House was going to try to kill this, correct?
So, yeah, I mean, the vote did pass to deprivilege the House resolution,
okay,
which effectively kills it, unfortunately.
Okay.
The margin was only by 3 votes, though, which is pretty impressive and pretty disappointing that 5 Democrats flipped on it.
Okay, so let me just be sure I understand. So if this measure clears the Senate, which it is expected to do sometime tomorrow or maybe, Friday, then it would go to the House. But it's expected, as the House is currently constituted, it would not come out of the House. So then when the new Congress is sworn in January, it's got to go through the process again. It's got to clear the Senate and then go back to the House. Is that right?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, exactly.
With the newly constituted House in January, then all things should be clear.
Yes, we are hoping so. I think the worry is that the incoming Senate might not be as friendly to this measure.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think the momentum from a past vote, when it passes tomorrow, crossing fingers, will hopefully bring it to the finish line in the new Congress.
Okay. Now, another related issue, United Nations chief attended the last day of peace talks on the Saudi-Yemen issue, which were taking place in Sweden, correct?
Yes, that's right. That
okay.
was taking place today and is supposed to end tomorrow at 11 a.m. So when we wake up tomorrow, we should know the results.
And so give us an update on where we are, where we're standing with that right now.
Sure. So what we're hearing is that 2 of the 3 main points that Martin Griffiths, who's conducting the talks, that he's pushing forward, 2 of the 3 have been agreed upon thus far. One is the reopening of Sana'a Airport, and we're hearing that there will be a prisoner exchange of 15,000 political prisoners from both sides. Both the government and the Houthi rebels have agreed to that exchange of prisoners. And then the Houthis have also agreed to stop fighting in the port city of Hodeida and to withdraw troops from the city and allow, moving forward, UN oversight over the city of Hodeida. And that's particularly important because Hodeida is the main city where humanitarian aid and fuel and all sorts of goods come from. It's a very important and bustling port city. So that really could be a game changer. And then the final piece, which we haven't heard about yet, but of course the talks are still ongoing, is on a political framework for a transitional government. So there's still a bit more time. The clock is still ticking on these agreements. But it seems that, you know, with the first two pieces, it seems like they're making significant progress.
Do you think that the vote in the U.S. Senate is having any type of impact, if not directly, on the process and outcome of these peace talks, at least people's perceptions of what the future could look like?
Yes, I definitely, from everything that I hear from partners who work on the ground, people in country, both Yemen and Saudi Arabia, honestly, are following really closely. Saudi Arabia really needs the weapons transfers that the U.S., U.K., France, you know, all of these global powers, they send to Saudi Arabia. And, you know, even the fact, even if, you know, President Trump is going to veto something, they know that the Trump administration is being watched really closely by Congress, and that's really important. And then even on the Houthi side, you know, they don't have a lot of love for the U.S. in general, which I think is somewhat understandable given our complicity in the conflict and, you know, our active role in providing arms and mid-air refueling and all of these military measures. But I think they're seeing that, you know, the American people are not behind that, you know, that it's and that, you know, the Senate and House are also starting to move away from it. And I think that that's really, really important moving forward as they look towards creating a more peaceful country.
What's your level of confidence that if all of the conditions and issues that are on the table right now in Sweden were agreed to, what's your level of confidence that they'll hold, that a peace treaty or peace agreement between the combatants would hold?
Yeah, I mean, I think it takes time and I think it takes trust between parties. So I think that we'll have to see how things go with kind of the smaller measures, such as the political prisoners exchange. And I think, you know, really importantly, we'll have to see a ceasefire. We'll have to see, you know, we'll have to see both parties allowing humanitarian aid into the country. And then something that's really, really important to victims, you know, that we see across conflicts, you know, really across the board, is the need for accountability. That's something that is often, you know, kind of left out or moved around in order to see an immediate peace. But in terms of conflict resolution, we often see recurring conflict when there is no accountability mechanism. And I think, you know, the huge amount of victims of this conflict really need to see justice.
I've had a challenge really trying to get to the crux of this fight. And I've talked to folks from Yemen. I've talked to you. What are the three major things that brought Saudi Arabia to attack Yemen? One of the things has been this discussion about the Houthis are backed by Iran and the Saudis don't want to see an Iranian-backed entity that close to their border. If that is in fact true, that's not being resolved here. So where does that play in this whole conversation? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think that's really been a huge part of the discourse, even on the U.S. side. Of course, we have a lot of discussion around Iran and what Iran's, you know, place in United States foreign policy is or should be. And that is a really important thing to consider when looking at the Arabian Peninsula. So I think, you know, I think in terms of Yemen, they really deserve self-determination. You know, mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia should not be determining their policy for them. And honestly, the Houthi rebels, you know, while they do receive some support from Iran, they really have their own grievances that go back decades. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. I don't think by any means that, you know, Saudi Arabia intends to halt its role in the conflict. I think what they want to see is a government in Yemen that is sympathetic to them, which, you know, currently is the government that they are backing in this war. And I think that they will, they'll look for, you know, ways to insert influence throughout the process. But I don't think by any means that they're, you know, going to be supporting Houthi self-determination in the process.
So as a final pin on this particular question and to start to wrap this up, is the Iran discussion, is that a red herring here, or is it being uber inflated as a rationale for U.S. involvement in backing the Saudis as they have been committing these atrocities against the people of Yemen?
Sure. I think it's completely overblown.
Okay.
And I'm happy to say that. I think that we've seen the discussion really change, especially as we've seen the true colors of the bin Salman regime in Saudi Arabia. I think, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric around Iran, and now there's different emerging rhetoric around Saudi Arabia due to, in particular, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but also because of their brutal tactics in Yemen. So I think it remains to be seen exactly what the relationship will turn into. But, you know, I think the brutality and, you know, the photos coming out of Yemen with starving children due to blockades on ports and lack of humanitarian access, you know, I think that folks are looking a lot more closely at that as opposed to only talking about the you know, the potential possible Iran influence over the conflict.
So are you expecting a vote out of the U.S. Senate on this issue tomorrow?
Yes, we are. So we'll just see what those amendments look like. I've heard that Senator Corker is offering an amendment. I haven't seen any language around that. So we're just hoping that it will remain a strong bill.
Well, Mac, look, just call Mitch McConnell and get this done.
I got to get on that. Yep. Anyone have a cell phone number?
I'll give it to you off the air.
Okay, great.
I don't want to do to him what they did to Lindsey Graham, what Donald Trump did to Lindsey Graham. So,
okay, that's fair.
Mac Hamilton, thank you so much, as always, for your prompt response, for your insight, and we look forward to, maybe tomorrow, look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Great. Thanks so much, Wilmer.
Thank you. All right, folks. And you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.